Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Welcome to Season 2, Episode number 14 of Cinematica. I'm Dan Slevin, and here with me in the Cinematica studio is...
Hello, it's Simon.
And Kaylee.
And I've got to say, Dan, you know, it's interesting talking to you before we start the podcast, and then all of a sudden it's like this, it gets into character, and there's this deep, husky Dan...
That announces the show.
It's great. I love it. But I only managed to keep it up for like about 2 minutes, and then about 2 minutes into the show, it's just normal. My normal voice takes over because I'm so relaxed around
that's
you.
That's right. Well, I think, you know, you're like the Cape Crusader, aren't you? You've just got this other persona.
Nice segue.
Welcome to Cinematica. I'm Batman.
How does he keep that up? I don't know. And he doesn't have a sort of mask over his actual mouth like
that. No, because he never shuts his mouth. Oh, so weird.
You can always talk. You're saying he talks too much.
All right.
His lips never actually physically close.
We're getting way ahead of ourselves here. In today's program, we check under the hood of The Dark Knight Returns. We unveil even more comic book movie news. We've got a special San Diego Comic-Con correspondent. And with the Auckland leg of the New Zealand Film Festival opening on Thursday night, we have an extract from our exclusive interview with the incredibly strange Aunt Timpson, and all that and more in this week's exciting episode. But first, let's check out the mailbag. Kaylee, do you have any two-word reviews from our listeners?
Did you say The Dark Knight Returns?
I did. I typed The Dark Knight Returns.
Can we pull you up on that?
Yeah, you can. Absolutely. Absolutely. Because I've been making that mistake I think I've been making that mistake since it was announced.
Okay. Oh, all right. Everyone for everyone out there, it's Dark Knight Rises.
Dark Knight Rises.
That's okay.
Yeah. It's Batman Bakes.
It's the bane of your Batman.
This is going to be puntastic, isn't it?
Oh, you bet.
Okay, so what's happening in the mailbag?
Oh, control ourselves. All right, so from Twitter, we have some two-word reviews this week. Sideways NZ. Two-word review for Ted, Cuddly Chaos. The Mirka, two words for Abraham Lincoln, which I am so looking forward to. Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, Gettysburg's a mess.
Mm. 200 odd people turned up on Monday night to a secret screening organized by Flix, and everybody thought they were going to see Batman, and they didn't. They got to see Abraham Lincoln instead. Which turns out, you know, it wouldn't have been as disappointing as all the people who turned up thinking they were going to see Tintin before Christmas and found that they were actually going to watch A Few Best Men. That was a disappointment, let me tell you.
Did you go to the Abraham Lincoln screening?
I didn't, no, unfortunately.
What was the tweet? What was the feedback like?
Good. Good, yes.
It looks, I mean, I've seen a little peep and it looks great.
Mm. I'm very excited. The book is great. I love it. Yeah. Rudy Six, two-word review for Ted, Sunday Laugh. And Miriam Ruth Ross, Spider-Man.
Dr. Miriam Ruth Ross.
Dr. Miriam Ruth Ross. Doctor. Spider-Man, Scaly Madness.
Yep.
Good
time. Nice work. Nice work, team.
Yeah.
Keep them coming in. And so what have people been going to see? Have they been saving their money for The Dark Knight Rises? Or what have people been going to see? Is Spidey still up there?
Yes, he is. Sitting pretty at number 5, Snow White and the Huntsman. Down to 4 from 3, we have Brave.
I went to see Brave again on Friday. I took my nearly 11-year-old niece.
What did she think?
Fantastic! Yeah. She loved it. I knew she would. I knew that she was going to get a big kick out of it. And I actually went to a 2D session on film, and it doesn't, you know, this animation, it doesn't pop anymore the way that it does, you know, on digital.
Yeah.
But still, a film that actually got better second time around as well.
Excellent.
I went and I went out and watched Three Stooges with the three kids.
Did you? Based on our glowing review. Recommendation.
Yeah, and I'd like to thank you for the warning. Yeah, no. I mean, hey, the kids loved it. What can you say? I mean, they had a good time.
Yeah, it's just people hitting people, isn't it, really?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Mm. And those Jersey Shore people were in it. Ooh.
Ew.
Yeah, and of course, me not having a television, it just was completely meaningless to me. Who are you people?
Oh. Anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. Down from 1 to 3 this week is The Amazing Spider-Man, still sticking in there. Man, I'm good with the puns this
week. You're on fire.
Sitting at 2 again is Ice Age Continental Drift, and up all the way from 4 to 1 is Ted.
Ted rules.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of money in that movie, and I don't imagine it costs that much to make either. So I think that we will see a lot more of that sort of thing from Seth MacFarlane.
I can see the sequel is going to be Jemima. You wouldn't hear this from play school, Kaylee.
Oh, I wouldn't.
That is a New Zealand. That's an iconic Kiwi reference. Mm.
Jemima.
So I should point out for Rudy Six as well, who's also probably bewildered by that particular reference. An excellent point. It's time to get into review territory.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light?
You are as precious to me as you were to your own mother and father. I swore to them that I would protect you, and I haven't.
The twilight's last gleam.
What are you?
I'm Gotham's Reckoning.
When Gotham is ashes, you have my permission to die.
Oh, three good bits, three emotional bits from The Dark Knight Rises. I can't take Michael Caine seriously.
Yeah, I know. My name. You just want to do it every time, don't you?
It is a career-ruining impression, that one from the trip. Anyway, The Dark Knight Rises, we have seen it. We're going to try and talk about it without spoilers. And boy, that's going to be a bit of a challenge.
Very tough.
Yeah, because even I've been so impressed with the marketing, the trailers for it. No spoilers in the trailers.
Yeah.
Finally.
Spoilers. And yet, if you watch the film, those trailer moments turn up and you go, right, that's what that's all about. Yeah, very, very clever.
Yeah.
I suppose we should start with a bit of plot summary, taking it up to the point of spoilerdom. Following on from the previous film, which was just called The Dark Knight, it's 7 years later. Harvey Dent, the crusading district attorney who went bad, is dead, but he is a hero to the city. They have a public holiday in his name, and also a law that keeps the criminals off the streets indefinitely. So a bit of fascist or authoritarianism in the name of Harvey Dent. Batman is retired because he's not needed anymore, because the police have basically got everything under control. But Gotham is sort of
He's taken himself out of retirement, hasn't he?
Well, Bruce Wayne's disappeared because he's grieving, and there's been no signs of Batman for 7 years. But Gotham's going soft, and there's hints of corruption in the seats of power, and you get the feeling that this uneasy truce or uneasy peace is about to break. A mysterious super criminal with a mask over his face that he talks through in a sort of Darth Vader-ish manner.
No, it's more like a Sean Connery.
Okay, so
I'll give you permission to die.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree.
All right,
with that.
So if Sean Connery had voiced Darth Vader, then that's what.
Yeah, but he wouldn't have been going so much.
No, maybe not. But yes, we did comment to each other that he is a little bit hard to understand at times,
yeah.
And there probably would have been some moments there where Batman could have gone, what? And just defuse the situation totally.
I think the best moment, the best version of that is he's talking to, I don't know, some evil corporate guy. You're pure evil. It's like, oh, okay, I guess.
No, I said I wanted a trim latte.
But anyway, this guy is the absolute personification of evil and may have some connections to Batman's past.
Mm.
But he is also in the process of basically cutting the central island of Gotham, which if it was New York, it would be Manhattan, but it's not New York, is it?
But retribution is coming, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right, exactly. And you know, all those crims that have been put away in the name of Harvey Dent, they may be out for retribution. So anyway, that's the setup. Batman, Bruce Wayne, is knocking on a bit, hence all of the warnings from Alfred about taking it easy and not necessarily putting the cape back on, because, you know, his knees are gone and etc. He's aimed
at an older audience, isn't it?
Is, is he really up for it? Is he going to be able to take these guys on? Also introduced to proceedings for the first time is Selena Kyle, the cat burglar known as Catwoman, played by Anne Hathaway.
And isn't she? She is really, really good.
She's great.
Yeah.
She's
I mean, they're all really good in this, but yeah. she.
It's a good character as well, really, because it's not. There's nuance, isn't there, to her character? There's a bit of backstory to her without making everything really obvious.
But she's strong, you know. She's a strong female character.
Yeah. And she looks great in that cat suit. Way to go, Anne Hathaway.
Yep, she does. She does. So, you know, that's all great. And of course, she's going to get involved in this plot as well. That's pretty much where we have to sort of stop it, because it starts getting pretty interesting, doesn't it? I have to say that there's quite a lot of times during the film where it stops and characters have to sort of explain things to other characters so that you can catch up, or that you can sort of have things explained to you. There's a lot of exposition there. Michael Caine does a fair bit. Morgan Freeman does a fair bit. And I wonder whether that's an example of the film having to sort of dumb itself down for the kid audience a wee bit, because it's a PG-13 rated film, right? So there's in the US it's an M. which is that crucial demographic in order to get everybody going. And I was at one of those Ian McKellen talks while he was touring the country, and he mentioned that one of the things, that if you go back and look at those Lord of the Rings films and how important it was that they get PG-13 for all the violence in all of those films, there's no blood.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
And this is another example where there's a lot of fighting, and there's a fair amount of gunfire and what have you, but not a drop of blood. And so I wonder whether Christopher Nolan, the director, whether he would have preferred to do something that talks down to the audience a little bit less, you know, that doesn't need, you know, so much explaining. Because I get the feeling that it's a clever script in there.
It's a hell of a clever script. I didn't get that feeling from it. And I also think that given the time that it runs for, it's engrossing from start to finish.
Yeah, I just think you've got to shave 20 minutes off without all the talking.
Well,
maybe.
But I don't necessarily agree, I think, because the tension builds, doesn't it? Very, very smartly, very, you know, methodically the whole way along. And I mean, it's a really good 2.5 hours well spent.
And for a comic book film, it is a grown-up picture, isn't it? Compared to the other ones that we've seen. The Avengers was really bold, bright colours, pitched at a really young age, lots of noise and movement. And this Batman, it does have a subtext. There's no question about it. And it is about growing old. It is about change. It is about loss. There's also, you could argue, there's a big sort of topic in there, which is, I guess, politics and the economy and the 99% and the 1%.
I was going to raise that, because I really thought that came through loud and clear, didn't it? There was this political commentary about this kind of corruption of the ultra wealthy.
Yeah, and that's why Gotham is getting its comeuppance, is because it's simply put too much of its power and too many of its resources in the hands of a corrupt few that don't care about the rest of the citizenry.
So maybe Nolan, you know, was already planning this in the last film, and that's why it was set in New York.
Maybe.
Or Gotham.
Maybe.
Gotham does happen to have a Saks Fifth Avenue.
There you go.
That's right. It's a very zeitgeisty sort of picture. But also, at the same time, there's a very authoritarian side to it, which is that basically you have to crush the baddies, and you have to put them away, and you need somebody like Batman to do your dirty work.
I thought there was another kind of political commentary in a way, because it was sort of like saying that, because Commissioner Gordon lives a lie, doesn't he, to basically make sure that they lock away all the crims. So they pass this legislation which is pretty
vindictive, isn't it?
Yeah. And you know, civil liberties are kind of encroached, and you kind of look at that and you go, well, you know, okay, in the context of what's happened in the past 10-15 years, you know, all those sorts of things happening in the US,
do you think the film is saying that you have to make these sort of compromises in order to keep your society stable and your society whole? Is it sort of fascistic like that, or is it suggesting that that's one direction and that you can actually pull back from the edge? I don't know. Maybe it's for somebody cleverer than I
think,
to
yeah,
go to
I mean,
work
can,
this stuff out.
You can take a lot out of it, I think, and you can read it in a number of different ways. I mean, it's very good. I mean, ultimately, it's just a really good story, isn't it? That works really well on many levels, and you can enjoy it.
It's got a fantastically successful ending. Like the last 10 minutes. We're not going to say anything about what actually happens. Just that, a bit like Men in Black. That you know, you might wonder through the film where it's going and how it's going to wrap itself up, and yet it does in a really sort of satisfying way. So that's good. You'll come out feeling good. There was one thing, just back to the political economy side of things. This must be the most terrifying film for Mitt Romney than you can possibly imagine, because not only is it about the 99% taking back their share of what's theirs, but the villain is called Bain. And Mitt Romney's company, the one that's in the news every day at the moment, the one that he supposedly wasn't in charge of, that was outsourcing and laying people off, was called Bain Capital. And so the word Bain is now going to be on everybody's lips.
Coincidence?
I think it is coincidence, but I think it's one of those juicy ones that just is perfect for the times. Is there anything else, Kaylee? You've been a little bit quiet there in the corner. Is there anything you want to add?
It's not really a spoiler, but the opening scene will really, really grab you. And when we were watching it, I immediately thought this opening scene is this like amazing fight sequence made Inception look like a calling card, like it made Inception look like a practice. It was just so cool.
The whole thing made Inception look like turgid piece of boring rubbish.
See, I don't agree with you. I never agree with you on this. I just think you're being really tough on Inception. A lot of players in Inception show their faces in this, don't they?
Yeah, it's all nice for you.
It's the repertory company. It's the Nolan repertory company. And actually, to be honest, there are a lot of really good people cast in some fairly minor roles. And there's an interesting cameo at the end from another of Nolan's favourite actors, who has already had a role in one of these Batman films. Did you pick that? I can't tell you because it's a spoiler, but we'll talk about it off air maybe, and just I shall point out what you might have missed. One of the things that I've always had a problem with Nolan is that his action sequences have always been basically incoherent. Like, you cannot at any point in any of the fights work out who is doing what to whom. You just have to wait for the fights to finish, and then you see who's standing. And this film is better. It's actually there's less of that frantic cutting that we're so used to. And in fact, there's one fight scene which is just one wide shot of Batman taking on a whole lot of punks under a bridge, and you actually get to see. It happens at that slow pace that a normal Hollywood fight scene, a traditional Hollywood fight scene, would have.
It's funny you say that, because I was watching it, I was thinking, this looks a bit slow. Like, it's almost like, I don't know, it was, you know, you're so used to seeing those things happening so quickly, like in
Batman. Yeah, cuts like 3-4 frames.
But Batman, he was kind of, you know, he's slowly turning around to try and hit somebody because he's got this big suit on. And,
it was,
you know,
realistic.
Like, it was really interesting.
Yeah, so there's a definite change in style for Nolan, and I think that it's a good one just in terms of his action. You could actually follow what was going on in the car chase scenes as well. You've got a sense, which I never got in the first two films, that I sort of understood where every vehicle was in relation to all the other vehicles, rather than just this Michael Bay style frantic cutting. And I haven't looked, but it may be that there's a different editor, or maybe that Nolan's just just got a little bit older, like we all have. Like
Batman, I was going to say, it's getting on.
Like Batman has, and has decided that he's going to, you know, take it a little bit easier. And maybe that's another reason why it's 2 hours 40, because he just cut a little bit less out than he would normally. Do we have two words? We should go around the table, shouldn't we?
Yeah, I'll start my two word review for Batman. Is bat-tastic.
Oh, well, somebody was going to come up with that.
I had to claim it first.
You went first.
Good
okay.
work, good work. Well, I mean, look, this is a 5-star film. It's engrossing from start to finish, and it just works so well. I mean, I was blown away by it. It really was.
That's a really strong recommendation from Simon.
So my three words today, because I'm going to have a crack at you, Dan, is Nolan brilliance again.
Okay.
Nice.
Yep, that's good. Well, you're a fan, so that's definitely a vote of confidence. My two-word-ish review is Catwoman's cute ass.
Is that with two S's?
Cute. Oh, well, you can pick and choose. You can choose whichever one
works
for you.
He's embarrassed. I don't think it crossed his mind. What the heck?
Well, it sort of did, actually. But in that cat suit. Well, I can be a little bit embarrassed because next week you're going to be talking about Magic Mike.
I'm not embarrassed. I am so excited.
Big Mike.
You're coming to watch it tonight too, so.
Yeah, but not with the same degree of anticipation.
When we got in here today, folks, the clock was ticking, wasn't it, Kayla? Come on, get up. Come on, we've got to get to this podcast. I've got to go to Magic Mike.
Yeah.
Move.
Yeah, there's free bubbles too.
Fair enough.
80s
too.
Night.
Yeah, 80s night.
Time for some news.
Next Friday night in Wellington, New Zealand, New Zealand cinema legend Sam Neill from Jurassic Park. Mm-hmm. Sam Neill?
Yeah.
The one and only. Will be appearing on stage for one night only. In conversation with longtime friend and Radio New Zealand film critic Simon Morris, Sam will talk about his early days on stage through to working with Meryl Streep, Steven Spielberg, and many, many more. The show is called An Innocent Abroad. Psht. And it's a fundraiser for Wellington's Downstage Theatre. And you can find out more by going to downstage.co.nz.
I think that's very good. It's going to be a fantastic night. Mm. Wellingtonians and all to a good cause. And Sam Neill doesn't give many interviews and he's been quite reticent about his career and shy, and I think he is just generally a pretty humble guy. Of course, he's got a winery to promote now.
Yes,
and expensive.
Those wines are good.
His
picnic wines that he just came out with are fantastic.
They are fantastic. But it's an expensive exercise running a vineyard, and so I think he is generally sort of coming out a little bit more in terms of promotion, and nothing wrong with that. But good for him, good for Downstage.
Good for Downstage, thank you. I don't think it's the wine driving this.
Well, it's funny you should say that, but the upstairs bar at Downstage is, on the night, will be renamed the Two Paddocks
Wine Bar. I'm
sure,
and that's fair enough.
Totally. Yeah, I'm a big supporter of all of it.
I'm a big supporter of Downstage just being able to keep on bringing us great stuff.
Great theatre, yeah, yes. Indeed. Yep.
In industry news, French media giant Studio Canal has bought Australasian cinema distributor Hoyts. Yeah. They are looking to grow the company and have a final installment of the Twilight saga to look forward to in November. Screen Daily says Studio Canal was buoyed by the impressive local numbers for Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which was more than $8 million US, and hope to...
That's across Australia and New Zealand. So that's a really good outcome for that film.
It's funny, though, because there was a different distributor, Tinker Tailor, for New Zealand than Australia.
Right. Okay, that's interesting. Mm. Good to know.
And hope to replicate those numbers with similar English language titles. CEO Oliver Corson also wants to foster local productions in the market. And I have to
say... They all say that, though, don't they?
I know, but I'm excited because pretty much most films I've seen that are done by Studio Canal are gold. Nah. Like, they have this, like, golden touch. Mm. They know how to make good films.
Definitely. I do think it's a really exciting thing for the Australian New Zealand marketplace, and it's nice to have somebody with some confidence and committing to the marketplace, as opposed to a lot of distributors recently who are still sort of a little bit wary about what the future holds.
True, but it's also, I guess, an indicator of you're losing a distributor. I mean, Studio Canal always had outlets for distribution.
True.
So they're actually, the market's downsizing a little in a way.
That's a very interesting perspective. We shall find out. We shall find out more as time goes on.
Yes. No offense, Hoyts. I just really like Studio Canal. I like you too, but. Finally, news today that Andrew Stanton is planning a sequel to the Pixar smash hit Finding Nemo. The original made over $860 US worldwide, $860 million worldwide, and the sequel to Monsters, Inc., which is titled Monsters University, is due out in June of next year.
Mm, all right.
Very good.
Just
on a little bit of news, I mean, you came across that article, it was all on the airwaves everywhere, wasn't it, about Jackson at Comic-Con and why they went 2D instead of 3D at 48 frames.
Yes, you sent a New York Times article about that.
I thought it was
fascinating, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The idea that the Comic-Con audience is so important now to the big distributors for those big tentpole features that they
get very nervous, don't they? If they get it slightly wrong, they're kind of worried that it's just out
there's
going to
be a backlash.
It's really interesting. I hadn't kind of thought. I thought Comic-Con was a bit more anarchic than that in some ways, but it's
maybe it was 3 or 4 years ago. But it's grown to such an important factor. It's the equivalent of the Cannes Film Festival for a particular sort of part of the marketplace. Mm. And people are launching films so far out now and trying to get the fanboys all juiced up.
And yep. fangirls. And
fangirls. I mean, yeah, fanboys in the broadest sense.
Because he did get a little bit of criticism, didn't he? There was a bit of negative comment about the 48 frames when it was shown at CinemaCon in Las Vegas.
And he realizes now, I think, that that was perhaps a mistake because he was showing ungraded, unfinished work, and that it wasn't necessarily showcasing the technology at its best. And actually showing 48 frames in what is a convention hall rather than a cinema probably would have done the same thing.
So, I've seen 48 frames in a cinema. I've got a little sneak peek, and I was really impressed with it. I thought it really, really delivered. I couldn't work out what some of the negative comments were about. So it'll be, it'll be interesting to see it in its entirety later on in the year.
Yeah.
But, because there's a big push for 48 frames coming with this release. And
a big push back as well, because there are quite a lot of people in the States who are suggesting that, that there's nothing wrong with 48 frames per se, but it's yet another surcharge for customers. They're already paying extra for 3D.
I don't think they should pay more. I don't think they should pay anything different than what they're paying now for 48 frames.
And do we know, is that going to be the case in New Zealand when it's released?
It hasn't been raised. So I suspect not. I think it's for me anyway. It's a marketing tool. It's something you can use and say, right, well, I've got 48 frames.
So all of our American listeners who are worried about having to pay a 48 frames per second surcharge, come to New Zealand at Christmas you won't have to pay it.
Well, you're welcome.
Yeah. I'm talking of fanboys and fangirls
at CinemaCon. Comic-Con.
At Comic-Con. You had a special friend at Comic-Con, didn't you?
A special friend,
Kaylee,
yes.
I mean, I don't usually ask this of people, but what was she wearing?
She was just wearing t-shirt and shorts. T-shirt, shorts, and Converse sneakers.
She wasn't sort of, dressed up as a Klingon, speaking Klingon or anything.
No, she wasn't. But I did interview her about some of the better costumes that she saw this year.
Oh, cool. Yeah. That sounds great.
All right, so we are here on the Cinematica podcast with Rachel Taylor, our very special guest this week, who was recently at Comic-Con in San Diego, arguably one of the world's biggest film, comic, and nerd conventions, wouldn't you say?
Definitely one of the biggest ones in the world. It certainly seemed like it at the time.
Yes. So let's dive right in. Rachel, what did you get to see of The Hobbit?
Unfortunately, I didn't get to see anything of The Hobbit. There was a trailer for it. It was at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and people started lining up at 7 o'clock the night before and camped out, slept overnight on the concrete in order to see The Hobbit. And unfortunately, although we showed up at like 5 o'clock in the morning, the lineup was like around the whole convention center and across the road and into the park, and so there was no way that we were going to get in even for 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So we decided that we would kind of head out and see the Hobbit exhibition that was in the exhibition hall, which looked really cool. There were some beautiful statues of the trolls. And some cool weaponry kind of designated to each dwarf. So I did get the chance to see that, but unfortunately I did not get the chance to see the extended special edition Comic-Con trailer, which was disappointing, to say the least. Also, apparently Martin Freeman was there, and I totally didn't see him. And that was quite a blow, let me tell you.
Yeah, disappointing for both myself and your brother, because your brother is also quite a big fan.
My brother is a huge fan, and I carefully did not tell him that Martin Freeman was there, because I feel like the thought of me missing both Game of Thrones and The Hobbit, and therefore missing both Kit Harington and Martin Freeman, would be enough to do him in.
Hopefully he doesn't listen to the podcast. Well, you know. Hopefully we're not breaking your heart, Patty. We're so sorry.
I'm so sorry.
So, no Hobbit, unfortunately, that you got to see. But what did you get to see in the way of movies?
Probably the movie that I am most excited about. It was from the Disney panel, because I did get into the Disney panel, which was awesome. And the movie that I am the most excited about is Disney's Wreck-It Ralph. I understand that that trailers haven't been released in New Zealand yet, so let me tell you just a little bit about it. So it's the story of a video game bad guy whose name is Ralph, Wreck-It Ralph from the game Fix-It Felix. And his catchphrase is, "I'm gonna wreck it," which is really funny when you hear the actor, John C. Reilly, do it over and over and over and over and over again. After 30 years of being a arcade video game bad guy, Wreck-It Ralph has decided he no longer wants to be the bad guy. He's really tired of doing his job so well and not having anybody appreciate him for it. And so he starts game jumping. So he ends up in games like Sugar Rush and Heroes Duty were two of the ones that I saw. Disney works very closely with Nintendo and Sega to get licensing for actual video game characters. So there are cameos from such beloved characters as the Pac-Man ghost, and Bowser shows up for a little bit, and Sonic. Sonic is a inspirational speaker, which is pretty funny. But really, like, the best part of the movie is hearing John C. Reilly say, "I'm gonna wreck it," because it's gonna be so good. And it kind of marries so many of my favorite things. One of them being John C. Reilly, as well as the kind of gaming popular in the very beginning, back when we were but knee high to a grasshopper and total noobs. As well as some really beautiful computer animation.
Excellent. Yeah, I think we can watch the trailer online, but it hasn't been released into cinemas yet, so definitely keeping an eye out for that one.
Definitely check it out.
Yes. What else were some of your highlights from 4 days, is it?
Yes. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Yes, 4 days.
It felt like an eternity.
It felt so long. It was both so long and so short at the same time. I believe it felt so short because we were always busy doing things, and so long because we never slept. Ever. What are the other highlights? For me, probably the biggest highlight, as you know, Kaylee, I'm a huge Joss Whedon fan. I'm a fan of all things Joss Whedon.
Yes, we do share a Buffy box set between us.
Yes, we do. I really need to mail it to New Zealand, actually. I think it's time to be in your custody for a while. So Joss Whedon, creator of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Angel, Firefly, Dollhouse, Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog, and this little movie about superheroes, you may have heard of it, called The Avengers.
Yes, and of course Cabin in the Woods, which is getting its New Zealand premiere after much hype and hoo-ha on Twitter.
I can imagine. I unfortunately still haven't seen Cabin in the Woods because it didn't come to Alberta. Like anywhere in Alberta. I tried to fly to Edmonton to see it and it wasn't there. So hopefully I get to see it soon. Maybe I'll fly to New Zealand to see it. But I got the chance to see him in his 10 years since Firefly panel, which was incredible, very heartwarming. Everybody cried, not just the audience, but also Joss Whedon and Nathan Fillion wept like children, and it was wonderful and beautiful and awesome. It was kind of intense, actually, because we, as I said earlier, people were camping out to see The Hobbit. And we camped out to see Firefly. So we slept on the street. We slept on the concrete. We started lining up about 9 o'clock in the evening to see his panel at 1 o'clock the next day. We made a mad dash back to our hotel room and stole pillows and towels and stuff so we had something to sleep on. And we were lucky enough that at 3 o'clock in the morning, Joss himself came down the line and was thanking people for caring so much about the show and wanting to see him so badly. And he was just a lovely, wonderful, warm, generous, humble human being. So many people ran up to him kind of, "Oh my God, you're Joss Whedon, you changed my life and your work is all so awesome." And his response was inevitably, I'm not the person to thank. There are so many people who worked on every single one of these projects, and I couldn't accept thanks on their behalf. So thank you for being such major fans of the show, but I'm not the person that you need to be thanking, which was very, very lovely of him.
Yeah, it's nice to know when the people you like are actually likable. That does help quite a bit.
Yeah, and he was one of the people. I know that there have been other people in the universe who are kind of like, Joss Whedon, he's not a very nice person. However, to those naysayers, I say naysay, because he's wonderful. He's a wonderful, sweet human being.
Excellent. And, you know, panels being one big part, but also meet and greets. And I saw on Twitter that you were able to meet and greet one of your humongous heroes, Felicia Day.
I did. I met Felicia Day. I did. I can't even believe that I can coherently talk about it, and clearly I can't coherently talk about it, so let's try that again. I met Felicia Day. I saw her panel for Geek and Sundry, and went to her autograph signing afterwards. And we just casually had conversation, which was great. There was a lull in the line ahead of us, and we were kind of right across from her, but behind the line, behind the red tape, and she called across to us and said, hey, did you come and see the panel, and what did you think of our brand new web series called Written by a Kid? So that's on the Geek and Sundry channel, in case you don't follow Felicia Day. She has a brand new series called Written by a Kid, and it launches on Wednesday, North American time, so on Tuesday, New Zealand time. And we got
Thursday.
To see the
other way Thursday. Around Thursday. So after you finish listening to this podcast, go find it.
Yes. Thank you. Because it will have come out just in time for you to see it, as opposed to when I said, which was wrong. time is hard. It's we got the first episode, and I thought I was going to pee myself. I was laughing so hard, because it's literally just they sit down with an 8-year-old boy, and they say, tell me a story. And so he tells the story of Joss Whedon plays a character named General Gerard of the SWAT team, who has to deal with a rampaging monster who killed the milkman. And that's all I'm going to say about that, except that it's also really awesome. And you should check it out.
Excellent. So, movie-wise as well, anything that you saw, anything top secret, you were sworn to secrecy that you could, you know, let a little tidbit out for our cinematic of listeners?
One movie that I had not yet been interested in seeing, but am now, is Tim Burton's Frankenweenie. We got to see a sneak peek, not only an exclusive trailer, but also a number of scenes from the movie. We got to see about 15 minutes of footage, and it looks really awesome. As you know, I'm not a huge fan of Tim Burton. I really love some of his stuff and don't like some of his other stuff, but this looks like it's going to be firmly in the camp of really love. It's done in stop-motion animation, which, as you know, is one of my huge passions, and I wish that I was capable of doing it or knew somebody who could do it so that I could write stories and then they could make it look beautiful. He brings back a number of people that he's worked with previously, Winona Ryder being among them, Johnny Depp, obviously, because he works with Johnny Depp all the time, and also Helena Bonham Carter, and they arrive to voice characters in his main character's class who are based on kids from when he went to school, and he was kind of the weird kid, and so he's projecting some of his weirdness on these other kids, and it looks really fantastic, very funny, scary probably a little bit because it's Tim Burton and he's kind of scary, but also surprisingly heartwarming because it's just the story of a boy who isn't ready to let go of his dog. And I think that pretty much everybody can relate to that story of not wanting to let go of someone that you love.
Mm-hmm. And it's a feature length because it's based on a short film he did really early in his career.
Yeah, it's based on a short film that he shot live, actually. The first one was shot live in 1984. And the story wasn't finished yet, is what he said when he spoke to us. So he kind of sat down. He finally got back to it because stop motion animation was now in a place that he could tell the story the way that he wanted to. And so it's a feature length film, Frankenweenie. Check it out. Maybe check out some trailers before you think about taking your kids because it might be scary. But it looks absolutely fantastic, absolutely phenomenal.
Excellent. And of course, cosplay is another big part of Comic-Con, where people dress up as their favorite film characters. A lot of Princess Leias this year?
Hundreds of Princess Leias, very few of whom are wearing underwear, it seemed to us. We kept kind of trying to scope them out and see whether they were wearing underwear or not, because we're super creepy. No, hundreds and hundreds of slave Leias wandering around, getting their pictures taken. However, I was amazed at the diversity and the creativeness that went into cosplay. I'm not a huge cosplay person. I've never really considered dressing up, but the time and effort that goes into these costumes are just stunning, stunning and incredible.
What was the best costume you saw this year?
My favorite costume was I hope that you are familiar with the Hunger Games, the most beautiful piece of cosplay that I saw was a Katniss. I saw hundreds of Katnisses, but this one was the best. She was a Katniss taken from about 3/4 of the way through the Hunger Games, so she had like Tracker Jacker stings and this big disgusting burn on the back of her calf, and her eardrum had burst, and it was the attention to detail was exquisite. It was absolutely beautiful. And it turns out that she was dressed as Katniss because she has a website called katnisschronicles.com. So feel free to check it out. I haven't checked it out yet, but I know a couple of my friends have and said that it was really cool. They're doing an audio interpretation of the book with a full cast, so sounds pretty neat. And if you've got a minute, you should definitely head by if you're a Hunger Games fan.
Excellent. And of course, as you know, you're familiar with the show. We love having our two-word reviews. So, Rachel, do you have a two-word review for San Diego Comic-Con 2012?
Am I allowed to swear?
Yes, we'll put in a warning right now. There's about to be foul language. I think we're off the hook with the people now.
Okay, fantastic. So my two-word review of San Diego Comic-Con is fucking brilliant.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Rachel, for being on the show.
Oh, not at all. I hope to stop by again soon.
Yes, and of course, if people want to find you on Twitter and look up your San Diego Comic-Con tweets, where can they find you?
I am on Twitter. My Twitter handle is SlamPoetRachel. That's all one word, all lowercase, at SlamPoetRachel.
Sweet. Thanks so much, Rachel.
Thank you very much, Kaylee.
So again, that was Rachel, who is at Comic-Con at San Diego, my very good friend, and yeah.
Great to get that first-hand experience of what it's like actually on the show floor. And are you tempted to make that trip yourself now, Kaylee?
Definitely. I really want to go next year. Unfortunately, yeah, gutted she didn't get to see any Hobbit stuff, but, you know, there's lots of other goodies that she was able to get to this year.
I've got a brother in San Diego.
A couch you could crash on.
Maybe we should make a group trip.
A Cinematica excursion.
Yeah, and then we can, like, interview celebrities and stuff.
Well, or we could just interview other people in the queues. Okay, if you're listening to the show on a Thursday, which is the first day of release for this week's episode, then the Auckland Film Festival opens tonight at the Civic and many other venues across the city. A major component of the Auckland Film Festival is the Incredibly Strange component, programmed by the incredibly strange Ant Timpson. I suppose spent a bit of time talking with him over Skype a few days ago about his background in the industry and where the Incredibly Strange concept came from, and also about the program for this year's Incredibly Strange part of the festival. The whole interview is about 45 minutes long, and it will be appearing in your iTunes stream about the same time as this episode, so you may have already heard it. But you'll be able to find it at the Cinematica website as well. Here's a taster, about 15 minutes of the conversation that I had with Ant Timpson, focusing on this year's festival and this year's program and some of the highlights. Joining me on the line from That Auckland is Ant Timpson, the head honcho of the Incredibly Strange section of the International Film Festival. Ant Timpson, welcome to Cinematica.
Thank you, Dan. Thanks for having me on this glorious day.
It's a glorious day in Wellington too. You're not alone in that. Let's start talking about this year, because this is obviously why we're talking to you now.
Yeah.
And this year's Incredibly Strange. How do you feel it stacks up alongside the ones that you've programmed in previous years?
It feels a little bit skimpy this year in terms of the number of films, and I think that was primarily because we lost a couple of titles at the last minute. I think this might be the smallest one section ever since 2004. I'd have to look back, but to me, I could definitely deal with a couple more titles in there. One of the late ones, Compliance, that I saw early this year that I really wanted. Bill and I both agreed that it was probably more suited to the main section, even though it's sort of one that I was chasing, and that's a great film. By Craig Zabel. If anyone hasn't heard about it, don't read up too much on it. Just go along and be prepared to argue with people after the film about the content of it. But yeah, I'm pretty happy. I think it's a really wide and varied mix inside the Incredibly Strange. And it's kind of cool this year that there's been previous years that have been kind of highly violent and kind of excessive in terms of the visceral nature of them, and I know that there's an audience for that stuff, and I always try to cater a title or so to those guys who are the gore munchers and who love the types of like the Dead Snows and all those sort of films, which yep. you know I'm a huge fan of as well. But you sometimes have, if you have a overbalance of those sort of titles, it can really cloud people's perception of the entire section. And I think even calling it Incredibly Strange can sometimes maybe put off an audience that I think should be coming to films like last year, Kill List, you know, might not necessarily be, even though I think it kind of fits the Incredibly Strange brand because it is a very strange hybrid film. Sometimes, you know, I think the audiences might overlook certain films that they should be really checking out.
You talked about the tussle between you and Bill over Compliance, and I think that that says how amorphous the relationship is now between the Incredibly Strange and the main part of the festival. I mean, a few years ago, something like Beasts of the Southern Wild, for example, would have been an Incredibly Strange film, and now here it is opening the main part of the festival. Do you find that those lines are harder and harder to find?
No, not at all. Not for me. I mean, there's no way Beasts of the Southern Wild would be playing in the Incredibly Strange section, even though in terms of if you read a plot description of it, it might feel like it could easily slot in. But that, you know, a film like that that's a, you know, a critical jury favourite from out of Sundance or whatever is probably not going to...
Yeah, I suppose you were never much one for Cannes winners, were you?
No. Oh, well, hold on. We've had a couple, actually, over the years. And this year we've got Sightseers by Ben Wheatley from the director of Kill List. And it has definitely won a lot of favour in Cannes. It was one of the sort of most... acclaimed films that came out of Cannes, not necessarily in terms of awards or prizes, but critical faves. But yeah, no, I'm pretty happy. We don't, you know, Bill and I don't really, we don't sort of put on boxing gloves and go hammer and tongs at each other over title. He's been very gracious in films that I've wanted, and that might have actually got bigger audiences within the main fest. But it's hard to know. There's always one of those questions that we ask ourselves every year about. Would they do better in this or whatever section you're in? A documentary, would it do better in the doc section, or will it do better in Incredibly Strange?
How do you
program it? Where do you source your titles for that section? Do you travel to festivals still yourself?
Yeah, I don't travel as much as I used to. I used to travel about 4 months a year to festivals, and then since having a family and everything, it's changed. You know, it's the brakes have been put on dramatically. I still probably get to maybe two a year, I think. But within that, I've got a lot of really good friends who are either festival directors or programmers for a lot of major festivals around the globe, and it's quite easy to keep heads up on certain titles. I mean, everyone wants to find those films that no one else has found, but the reality is they're not going to premiere down here unless they're local films. It's very hard to get dibs from sales agents for premieres down here. So we, you know, it's not rocket science really to find. It's just films that reflect your taste, and it's quite, you know, there's a lot of selfish behavior behind certain title selection as well. There's probably some that I know, Bill will probably hate me for saying that, I know are probably going to bomb, but I really just want to play the film. And then so sometimes there's more populist films, like Cabin in the Woods, obviously, is going to be a very, you know, successful film, and it's one of the fastest selling already. So
yeah, I wanted to ask you about that and actually get your take on the Cabin in the Woods phenomenon and what the heck was going on there in terms of the distributor not wanting to release it.
Well, I mean, I know the distributors really well, and I know the thinking behind certain horror films in this territory, and you know, they're not basing it on on some sort of gut instinct. They're basing it on hard data over a long period of time that certain non high profile, what am I talking about? Things like paranormal, Blair Witch, that are kind of like phenomena overseas are easy sells, right? Because they are sort of one-off anomalies in terms of, but generic horror stuff, and I'm not saying Cabin in the Woods is generic by any means, but I'm just saying films that don't have $150 million sort of grosses domestic in the US sometimes really struggle here. Even ones that have got legs, like films that don't open that strongly but continue really healthy runs, like Insidious, they're sort of films that don't even get a chance to live here because they won't let the they don't grow an audience. They basically die after their first weekend. They're very much front-loaded. So it's not just distributors making the call. It's the run that they've had with exhibitors, and then just not hot on horror. And so one of the ideas behind Cabin in the Woods was to show distributors that, hey, smart, intelligent horror films do have an audience here. Let's show them by turning up en masse to these festival screenings and sending a very direct message back to everyone that, hey, they can work for certain films that are good. We're not saying every piece of crap that comes down the pipeline is going to pull an audience in. But this film definitely has the caliber. Plus, it's also got Joss Whedon's fans who are like one of the most obsessive fan groups out there, the Buffy and the Angel legions of fans, and, of course, now the Avengers, are very much guys who will turn up and walk the walk in terms of buying tickets.
Do you think that a distributor like Roadshow is built to, I guess, understand or appreciate or make use of a fan base like that? Do you think that a major distributor like that is nimble enough to be able to take advantage?
Well, everything is so scheduled in advance that to have last-minute sort of changes in the scheduling really has a domino effect on the way that everything is planned out in terms of their competitive release scheduling. So it's not just what they change, it's how it changes everything else in the marketplace of terms of screen space. So I think there's a lot of thought that goes into these films, like how much is going to be spent to release the film, what's going to come back in, and is it worth it? It's just really a bottom line. Do they get it right every time? I mean, I don't, maybe not, but then it's like no one, it's like William Goldman's classic line, right? Nobody knows anything.
Yeah, exactly. I was just thinking that very same thing.
So there's no formula prediction, even though they've got box office numbers a lot of the time because the films open here after the US. There's anomalies that work down here that don't work in the US. So it's very hard to predict. But horror is just this one particular genre that hasn't had a great record outside of those phenomenons like your Blair Witches and things in this territory.
Yeah. Do you feel that that the industry as a whole is becoming a little bit more gun-shy, just in a little bit more risk-averse in terms of what it releases and maybe the release patterns?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you just look around what's filling the screens. I mean, it's just all animated kids flicks, giant high tentpole titles. Even though, you know, there's enormous numbers going to certain films, overall, if you really step back and forget about box office numbers, which obviously then everyone operates on cash flow, but there's definitely a decrease in the attendance numbers, no matter what stats you look at. It's tough. It's really tough out there. So, you know, the studios that are just making films that appeal to the widest demographic, they take up all the screens. It's incredibly hard. The idea of the Shangri-La that everyone had of, hey, you've got 12 screens, that means more films are going to be on. It's got the choice is just going to be incredible. It's like, yeah, but you've got 12 films that are exactly the same.
Mm.
You know, it's very, very tough out there for the independent smaller films. No, I'm not even talking local. I'm just talking very interesting films from overseas. And it's lucky we do have art house chains in this country. And for, you know, it would be a completely different playing field if we didn't have those other indies that are out there.
Okay, one more question about this year's festival. And you talked about earlier on about how your own taste sort of guides you through all of the choices that you have. Which is your personal favorite, the one that you think that if people went to see it, they would go, oh, right, that's one of Ant's type of films?
Well, even though I've put money into buying this film, which is a somewhat conflict of interest that I had to clear with the festival early on, but I would stand behind Clown as probably the most bang for buck in the lineup. The Danish comedy is really one of the great crowd experiences that I had last year when I saw it with a packed house. It really, there's nothing as quite infectious as watching a film with a crowd that is absolutely, you know, gut busting laughing. I mean, I have to go back to Something About Mary and seeing that film really early on and wanting to take people to it to sit next to them and watch it. I mean, there's really a euphoric high that you get off a film that really delivers massive, massive laughs. And Clown is very much, if you're for people who dig Curb Your Enthusiasm, it's so similar in tone to that, but on a big screen canvas. So even though it's got Hangover sort of similarities, it's not an American style film at all. It's very, very Danish in its sensibility, and a lot of the humour is incredibly dry and black, but it delivers possibly the best outro gags of all time of any film that I can't wait to see it with a crowd. So your Clown, the Danish comedy, very, very funny guys. They're going to, if you love the film, then they've made 6 seasons of the same characters. They play themselves in this film. They're guys who are very well known in Denmark, two comedians who play versions of themselves, like hyper-real versions of themselves on the show. And this is the big screen debut, which is a monster, monster smash hit in Denmark. So, yeah, Clown and also Ben Wheatley's Sightseers, who right. I just think Ben Wheatley is one of the great, great up-and-coming directors on the scene, and every film he has made, he's made 3 knockout films, and I just can't wait to see where this guy's going. He's just got so much enthusiasm for making films that you see it in every single frame.
Brilliant. Hey, I've got the Wellington program in front of me, and I'm looking at Clown, and there's only one screening, which is a late night Saturday, well, late-ish night, 10 p.m. on Saturday the 11th of August. Is it getting only one screening in Auckland as well?
No, it's got a couple in Auckland, but it's, you know, it's in the Civic Theatre,
right,
on Tuesday, July 31st, 9:30, and it's got a couple of big ones. So, yeah, I think Wellington, though, is always extremely tight in terms of the amount of films that play in Auckland and versus the amount of screens available in Wellington. So I think everything's very much reduced in terms of the amount of sessions.
So it's definitely it's definitely people have to really pick their way carefully through through those, because there's not many opportunities to see these films.
No, and I mean, it's hard, you know. I mean, I remember what it was like packing titles for the festival back in, before I was working for it, and it's one of those scheduling nightmares that everyone goes through that takes up half your night of highlighter pen and you know, mathematical calculations that sometimes strain your brain. So yeah, it's tough and it's expensive, and so people have to be really choosy these days. So I'd say choose clown if you're going to choose one. And of course, you know, hopefully some money comes back in so we can maybe pick up further films and get them on the screens down the line. So there's a trickle down effect, obviously, Dan, as well.
Fantastic. That's from the horse's mouth. That's Ant Timpson joining us from Auckland to talk us through the incredibly strange component of the New Zealand International Film Festival this year. Ant, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Dan. You know, we could have chatted all day about subjects that no one's interested in except you and myself. So I'm very grateful that you offered me a platform to shill my films to the public. And I am here whenever you need me.
That was Ant Timpson from the incredibly strange component of the New Zealand Film Festival, opening in Auckland on Thursday and in Wellington next Friday. And you can hear the rest of that interview on a special Cinematica Extra, which is downloadable from the website or from iTunes as well. We've got time for just one more brief review, because Dark Knight wasn't the only film that was released this week.
Ja, du är ju sjöman, så du vet ju vikten av disciplin. Man är en del av en besättning, man har ett gemensamt mål. Och vårt mål är att försöka hitta en hedlig, ödmjuk och nyttig liten kristen pojke här inne. Och hittar vi inte honom så blir du kvar.
There's no language quite like that, is there?
Was really? That Stellan Skarsgård?
It was.
Incredible voice.
Yeah, lovely
incredible.
Voice.
Is there anything that family can't do? Like, that is like the legacy family of cinema and television.
That was an extract from The King of Devil's Island, which is playing in Wellington at the moment. It's a film that's returned from the World Cinema Showcase and will probably sneak around to other cinemas around the country over time. I got to see about an hour of it last night before I had to crash, unfortunately. But you've seen the whole thing, haven't you, Kaylee?
Yes, I did. I watched it before bed, and I do not recommend it.
Nightmares. It's the stuff of nightmares, isn't it?
Not quite nightmares, but uneasy, ooh, like cheese dreams, you know?
Cheese dreams? What, is that melted cheese?
No, like when you eat cheese, blue cheese. Like crazy psychedelic dreams.
Mm. What's it about, Kaylee?
I think you're putting the wrong stuff in your cheese.
So, King of Devil's Island is based on a true story of the infamous Bastøy Boys Home Correctional Facility in Norway, and this film takes place around the early 20th century. And a new inmate leads the boys to a violent uprising against a brutal regime, but how far is he willing to go to attain freedom? It stars Stellan Skarsgård as kind of the ruler of the boys' correctional facility.
Headmaster, I suppose,
headmaster.
If it was a school.
It's mostly a cast of young men who are incredible. Most of them, it's their, you know, first or second film. And the performances are incredible in this film. It's directed by Marius Holst, who is mostly, I believe, a Norwegian director, so nothing that I have seen over here. But the DOP, John Andreas Anderson, was also the DOP for Headhunters. So if you enjoyed Headhunters and the look of that, you are in for a treat, because this film, although this subject material is quite dark, they've really matched it with the directing style and the shooting style, and it is beautiful. It is is absolutely gorgeous, absolutely haunting and terrifying, because these boys go through some really, really horrific things, and just knowing that it's based on true events is quite scary as well. But yeah, fantastic cast. As I said, especially from the young men, and getting the performances was just amazing.
There's no denying that it's not it's quite a violent wee piece, isn't it? You know, it's a brutalizing environment for these young kids, and there's no, you know, it's not the kind of film that it's not a date movie.
I was gonna say it's not a first date film.
No. Just on the subject of headhunters, just this little digression, Rialto Distribution sent me a screener DVD for the new Joe Nesbo called Jackpot the other day. I haven't seen it yet. Yeah. Not due out till September, but looking forward to that because Headhunters was so good. And that was a film that I didn't really know very much about before it turned up. But I keep reading great reviews of it as it's slowly working its way around the world. People are discovering it. So very much looking forward to seeing that. Do you have a two-word review for...
I do, but first, I have just one wish. I know it's really cheesy, but I really wish this director and DOP team could get together and do the rest of the Hunger Games films, or maybe do like a Norwegian Hunger Games, because it was just so dark and gritty and like fantastic.
See, that's what it needs.
Yeah, I think especially for the second and third of the installments. Mm. So my two-word review for King of Devil's Island is Haunting Portrait, and if you get a chance to see it, I definitely recommend it.
Fantastic. I'm gonna bail on a two-word review, seeing as I'm going to watch the last 50 minutes of it tonight, and I may come back next week with one.
Your two-word review could be half done. Like you have
a one-word review.
Oh, half
done. I'll give you the second word later, a little bit later on. And that is our show for this week. Next week on the show, Channing Tatum and Matthew McConaughey show us their goodies in Magic Mike. We'll be talking to the creative team behind the Wellington feature Existence, which is going to be screening in the Wellington Film Festival a little bit later on. So some an extra feature there. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to click subscribe in iTunes or your own favourite podcasting software so the latest episode is always downloaded automatically. Please leave us feedback at the iTunes store. That sounds a bit needy, doesn't it? Actually, I might change that.
We are needy.
We are a little bit needy. It would be really, really nice if you'd leave us some feedback at the iTunes store, ratings, reviews, etc. And if you get an iTunes account for different territories, give us ratings and reviews for each one.
And we can go international.
Yeah.
And then we can thank you.
Indeed.
We'll make you a button.
For other kinds of feedback, two-word reviews, etc., you can contact us via social media.
Yes, you can find us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at CinematicaCast. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast, or, of course, on our website at cinematica.co.nz.
The show is a Guns of Steel production. It's produced, engineered, and edited by me, Dan Slevin, the news editor, weather girl, not so much the ratings wrangler anymore, Kaylee Carruthers. The theme music was 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke. You can buy it at the iTunes store. We're going to leave you with some music from The Dark Knight. This is Hans Zimmer's The Shadows Betray You. Until next week, it's good night from me.
And it's good night from me.
And it's good night from me.
Nice.